newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record.
We are on the Media Project. It's a half hour of commentary and analysis, and in our best days, some thoughtful insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, the editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Sir.
Sir.
There you go.
Primed and ready.
That was our civility for the day. Ira Fussfeld is here, the publisher emeritus of the Kingston Daily Freeman and affiliated publications in the Hudson Valley.
Hello, Rex and all.
And I hope you're well.
Thank you.
I don't mean to not call you sir, just to...
You didn't say you hope Alan is well.
Well, I do. I do. I do. We especially care about Alan, knowing that he has had some infirmities recently we want him to get over. And Barbara Lombardo is here, formerly executive editor of the Saratogan and the Record of Troy.
Great
and,
to be here.
A journalism professor, I guess, right?
Yes.
You profess?
Absolutely.
She professes, absolutely. So we have a lot to talk about here. The coverage of the death of Jeffrey Epstein has been, of course, a huge topic. Coming as it does in the midst of years of coverage now of the Me Too movement, of an increasing attention to sexual impropriety in the media, to sexual assault, and then, of course, in New York State, the revelations of sexual assaults by members of the clergy and so on that are coming out as a result of the new opening of a window for people to sue. So these are difficult topics to cover in the mainstream media because they involve a lot of issues that have traditionally been swept under the rug. You find yourself, I think, sometimes writing about, talking about on the radio things that in specifics you wouldn't want to discuss, right? How do we deal with that? How do you deal with the reality of the coverage when it's often very difficult to talk about?
Well, times have changed. The specificity and the level of detail about a story like this is reported differently and more directly today than it might have been a decade ago or certainly longer than that. The mores have changed. The amount of information and the various number of places you can get information have expanded. And, you know, it's up to us in the mainstream to determine where the line has moved. And the line certainly has moved.
One of the things that bothers me so much about the whole thing is, you know, our recalcitrance as journalists to report certain things because we don't like them. For example, Rex, your newspaper did a very fine story this morning about our former bishop, Howard Hubbard, here in Albany, who has been named because of the ability to look back now by somebody from many, many years ago. Now, I've always loved Howard Hubbard. I'm not going to lie about that. I've always thought he was a great man. He's come on to the radio with us and the television with us and talked to us over the years. And now here's an accusation. And that, of course, is the point. It is an accusation. We don't know that it's true. We just know that it's an accusation. But I know that every fiber in my body hopes it isn't true.
Yes, I think you have to be unstinting in covering it, but you do present the fairness. The hard thing is when somebody's accused, they often don't wish to respond other than to say, I am not guilty of these offenses because they don't want to involve the case. They don't want to ruin their case. What, though, about unfounded fringe theories? You know, President Trump went on to Twitter in the aftermath of Jeffrey Epstein's death and put forward the notion that he had information on Bill Clinton and now he's dead, without evidence to substantiate that. But what do you do as a journalist when the president tweets something that is absolutely unsubstantiated and cannot be substantiated?
Well, now, you know, Rex, he's a marketer. That's what Trump is. He's also a lying liar. Remember in the beginning of this program, we used to argue as to whether it was appropriate to call a president of the United States a liar, but a liar he is. Now, here's a guy who stood up and defended Epstein himself. He said Epstein likes girls, young girls. Basically, he likes Epstein. And now he's diverting attention from himself and telling what a lot of people think is a lie about Bill Clinton. So it's extraordinary that the person who markets themselves and markets their lies better gets away with it. And once somebody has been named, a lot of people believe it.
I think that you have to be very careful when clearly Trump did not care that there was no veracity to that claim. He just wanted to get it out there and rile things up. He could care less if it was true or not. And the responsibility for the media is to tell the public that the president of the United States is doing this, that he's passing these words along, but not caring whether there's any truth to it. But then I think the media needs to then step back And when we just keep talking about it over and over again, and what do you think about it, and what do these other talking heads think about it, and what does it mean, that it gives more and more prominence to the ridiculous stuff and dangerous things that he is tweeting, especially that particular lie. And I think that's a problem.
Mayor de Blasio of New York did the same thing. He said, oh, it's just too convenient. It's too many pieces happening simultaneously. They don't fit. In effect, putting forth the notion that the death of Jeffrey Epstein was somehow concocted. Now, there is an investigation underway by the Justice Department. That's worth doing. But
de Blasio's comment was not out of bounds, in my view, because he was just saying something doesn't seem right. Let's investigate it, as opposed to somebody who just developed out of whole cloth a theory that the Clintons were involved. And then Trump retweets it, giving it some life. In the old days, if that kind of an assumption was brought to the editor of the New York Times or any big newspaper, it would never get in print.
That's correct.
Now it gets in print because the president has retweeted it. So go back and take this into context. Should that quote have been used, or should that theory have been used, even though the president said it?
Because the president said it is why you have to let people know, because you need to know not that the Clintons were involved in some conspiracy, but that the president of the United States is spreading terrible falsehoods.
Right, but by doing so, you're in,
right.
also
rocking a hard place.
You're also bringing light. You're also breathing life into it, and it's
yes.
being
yes.
and you're exposing it to many people, perhaps most people who did not see the original comment or the retweet.
We're getting an awful lot of mail here at Public Radio telling us that we are irresponsible for saying anything that the president says. In other words, here's the most powerful man in the world. You report what he says. Now, we have changed. So CNN does not put on the stuff that he's been doing, standing up before thousands of people. They used to, but they don't do
it
anymore.
They're putting it on, but they're putting on an edited version.
Well,
finally.
That's right, I heard.
They're just not showing it live.
But that's a difference, isn't it?
Well, yes, but the more outlandish comments are still getting aired.
They're absolutely. Just,
you know, it is right. an interesting point, though, that Ira raises, that the nature of social media is such that it kind of leads traditional gatekeepers to more regularly engage in spreading conspiracies, because they are out there through social media. And so rather than fighting them, here we are, in effect, spreading them by
right.
reporting them, because they are put out there by potent people, by the guy who Alan labels the most powerful man in the world. I'm not sure. I think that might be Vladimir Putin.
Oh, I was going to say Mitch McConnell.
None.
Trust me, it's the president.
Kim
and
Jong-un.
McConnell is his lapdog. let me just say that we are in a very tough time here, because we have this guy as president of the United States. And it does raise all kinds of ethical questions and moral questions for journalists.
Often.
And by the way, Rex, I just want you to know, I think it is an open question. I don't think it's a conspiracy, but I think it's an appropriate open question to question why this guy, Epstein, was left alone in a jail cell
oh, yes.
so he could hang himself. And I do believe there's a potential here, a potential that somebody put the word out.
But much like de Blasio, what you're suggesting seems to me fair commentary, where what we saw too much of is what I call idle speculation, where they not only felt that there was something going on here, but commentators were speculating on who or what it was. They have no idea. We can all be suspicious, but it does them and the public, more importantly, no good to spread speculative comments that likely have no basis in fact.
I was
just going to say that it is important, though, that we continue to report on all the facets of this case, continue to call it an alleged suicide. And I think as we're taping this, there was an autopsy report that shows that his injuries could have been from hanging, could have been from strangulation, who knows. And it smells like more than just incompetence. It smells like people looking the other way. We need to keep it in the news, and we need to bring him and his cohorts to justice.
I agree with you. And when you look at the people that he was hanging around with, Epstein, these are the most powerful people in the world. And therefore, it becomes appropriate for us to be skeptical about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. And on that point, actually, there's another journalism ethical issue raised. The most powerful people in the world. There is a New York Times columnist, James Stewart, who published a column about a conversation he had a year ago with Jeffrey Epstein, in which Epstein talked about how He had a lot of dirt on powerful people. He never named the people, never said what exactly the dirt was. But here is the thing. That conversation that James Stewart, the columnist, had with Epstein was an off-the-record conversation. Or on background, he said, when I contacted Mr. Epstein, he readily agreed to an interview. The caveat was that the conversation would be on background, which meant I could use the information as long as I didn't attribute it directly to him. Parentheses, I consider that condition to have lapsed with his death. Is that true? Does an off-the-record or an on-background label expire when the subject does?
Well, once again, I have to quote the famous philosopher Billy Martin, who said, I feel strongly both ways. it seems to me that certainly if once someone dies, you don't have to honor your commitment. You certainly don't have to worry about being sued because the dead man was not going to sue you for libel. So there's no reason why someone can't do that, but it makes me uncomfortable. You promise someone anonymity, you should honor that.
Even when they're dead.
Yeah.
It depends. I think it depends.
That's why you feel strongly both
the same way.
That's exactly right. I think it really does depend. And I teach my journalism students, and I used to hopefully teach my reporters that words like on background and for the record and off the record, that you really need to discuss with the source what you're talking about so that you both understand what it means, what the rules are that you think you're playing by. But never, ever in 40 years of doing this have I ever said, well, oh, yes, I'll talk to you on background, but if you die, I might use it.
Right.
So never even thought about that.
However, you do have conversations, at least the investigative reporters, the best of them do have conversations in which they say, okay, we'll keep this on background. You are not my source. But if I ever have to testify, if I'm ordered by a judge to reveal my source, may I reveal your name at that point? And we actually have had people who would say, yes, okay, under those circumstances, you can.
Doesn't it make you feel uncomfortable as an editor to know that a story is based on something that was told in background and that you know who the person was, but the people who you're serving, your readers, do not know who it is? Your job, our job, is to report as fully as we can. But I'm uncomfortable about holding secrets from our readers.
Uncomfortable, but I feel it's sometimes necessary because think of the code of ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists. I'm sorry I often cite this, but
you
I've
do
got
too often.
The four major tenets
if
painted
I do Billy Martin, you can
on
do
our
that,
conference yeah. room wall, and so I see it every day, all the time. Seek the truth and report it as fully as possible is the
I'm
major
I'm going to throw
thing.
Up. Yeah, go ahead.
Seek the truth and report it as fully as possible. And then the fourth tenet is be transparent. So that's what you're talking about is transparency. But that is number four for a reason, because reporting the truth is the fundamental goal. And if reporting the truth requires you to maintain the anonymity of a source, I think we need to do that.
You know, I don't know, Rexy. Look at Deep Throat. There's a classic case, right?
Right.
It turns out the number two guy in the FBI turns out to be Deep Throat, right?
Right. We find out 40 years later, yes.
We find that out 40 years later, mm-hmm. but the FBI had a role in all of this, and a very powerful agency. Mm-hmm. And while a lot of people respect the fact that Woodward and Bernstein kept his counsel, it seems to me it's open to some speculation.
What is? I don't know.
The idea that the second most important law enforcement person in the United States was giving you this information, and that might have had influenced what information you were getting and why.
Yes, and you make those judgments very carefully, which is why we don't have reporters doing it themselves. Our newsroom policy is that if you are going to use a background source, the reporter and an editor need to know about it. Not just necessarily me, but more than one person needs to be involved, because that's actually a promise of confidentiality that comes not just from the reporter, but from the institution, from the newspaper. But I think there are many times when there are good reason why people can't have their names divulged. In this case, in the case of Deep Throat, he would have been unable to continue in his job he wouldn't have been. And you're right, Alan, that I'm sure there was some question on the part of the reporters as to why, what was the motivation, right?
Exactly.
For this guy giving the information on the president. Some would say it was patriotism, that he thought that this information about Richard Nixon needed to get out there so that people would know it.
Well, let's bring it to the contemporary times. The FBI, which at the time was regarded by many people as beyond reproach, is no longer regarded that way. And now we have a president of the United States who's firing FBI directors because they don't adhere to loyalty to him. So I think that the institutional issues become very important.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
Similarly with off-the-record comments, Trump, I would say, generally speaking, the public respected the notion of so-and-so said something, but it was off the record, if they read that in a newspaper. Whereas now, Trump is saying flat out, mostly about the New York Times and Washington Post, is that their sources are fake. They don't even exist, newspapers are making it up.
This is a problem with, I haven't done a count recently, but I just anecdotally feel like there are tons of stories in the New York Times about the White House and the administration that are keyed to unnamed sources over and over again. And I understand on the one hand that might be the only way for the reporters to get that information. On the other side, you're only talking to somebody with a specific point of view. You could be making it up. You could be misinterpreting. You can, I think it hurts our credibility when those are your only sources. But what else are you supposed to do?
What else are you going to do? Yes, I mean, and that's why reporting requires really thoughtful, good professionals, because you weigh the motivation of people. You get more than one source. You don't just get a whispered phone call from someone and then go running with that into print, at least not if you're a reputable, decent journalist, certainly not if you're a Washington correspondent for a reputable news organization. So yes, I mean, those are all perils, and that's why journalism needs to be practiced well, and that's why we need to have certain standards, and why good editors, if you're let's say you're one of the Washington editors of a major news organization, of the Los Angeles Times or of ABC News or of NPR, you're going to be grilling those reporters who bring you stories and saying, okay, who's your source? Who else is saying this? What do you mean White House officials privately say? What does that really mean?
And wouldn't you agree also that it's very important to have sources that talk to you on background?
Yes.
That's really a key component of good reporting.
It is.
People who can explain to you the background, put things in context, tell you who else to check your own facts. And my understanding is correctly.
Maybe it's lazy reporting.
Lazy. It is not lazy reporting.
Well, you don't
it's
know.
Responsible
you don't know.
Reporting.
Well, I don't know. I understand. If you're a reporter, you want as much information as you can. But what kind of a deal are you making in order to get that information? That seems to me to be something people listening to this radio station right now are going to be saying in their own minds. You shouldn't have agreed to that. That was too easy a get. Rex and I knew a guy around here who once was quoted as saying, "I have a source, and he's a good one."
Now, as opposed to some of the others
and he's a good one. What? And how about all the bad ones? Are you using bad ones too?
Well, that's why one of the lines when somebody says we use a reliable source, well, I hope you used a reliable source.
Right.
For a change.
Or sometimes you'll say a usually reliable source, meaning, no.
But there are some rules about that. Does the person have firsthand knowledge of what they're talking about?
But people have been fired, right? People have been fired for having made up sources.
Oh, that has happened, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we can cite their names, James Glass and, I'm just losing
Janet
the
Cook.
Names here. Sorry?
Janet Cook.
And
sorry.
Janet Cook. And, the people who make up things in the media, they lose their jobs and they get a lot of publicity. The fact that we can cite their names is a reason for us to say that we police our own.
Well, it depends if the glass is half full. I mean, I think that our industry should be praised for coming to grips with these kinds of people firing them and then publicizing what it is we did. On the other hand, those who don't like us will overlook the honorable things that we did and go back to the original sin, was what you had reporters that made up stuff, and maybe you found out about this one, but what about all the others
exactly.
who you haven't found
exactly
out?
Exactly right.
That could be. You know, speaking of criticism of news organizations, St. Bernie Sanders himself has been very hard on the Washington Post. He was campaigning in New Hampshire, and he was talking about Amazon's taxes. He said, I talk about that all the time. And then I wonder why the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, doesn't write particularly good articles about me. I don't know why. Implying that the Washington Post newsroom is too hard on Bernie Sanders because he has been hard on Amazon.
You know, very Trumpian of him.
It's very Trumpian.
Yeah, but
you
know what? He put his foot in his mouth in attempting to back off of that a little bit by saying, no, I know that Bezos doesn't call the newsroom. But he also said, one of the complaints I have, for example, is that I have never had a reporter ask me about income inequality, which is one of his big issues. Well, that immediately prompted people who did some homework to report at least four different instances where he was asked exactly that about income inequality.
Sure.
So he would have been better off just, I view it as just a sense of desperation on his part.
Well, let me make it clear. I voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary the last time out. So I have some credibility in this. But what I think what he did the other day was disgusting, really disgusting. And I think it was just unprincipled and wrong of him to do.
There are three editors and one broadcast executive here. I dare say all of us have had complaints from politicians that our coverage of them was unfair. I mean, that's just built in. It's baked into the notion of politics and the press. Nobody gets the kind of press
that they want.
What is unfair?
It is unfair because we have to make decisions all the time.
Well, that doesn't mean they're unfair decisions.
Well, no, yeah, but we have to make decisions.
It ends up being unfair, and I think all of us who have run newsrooms have heard that from politicians, and we can empathize with Sanders' concerns where he says, I don't make the news because I didn't say anything I didn't say yesterday. I didn't come up with something new. I'm repeating the same story. And
that's
you can't keep saying it over and over. And yet, think of it, if you were the politician trying to get public attention, and whether it's the city council or a state office or somebody running for president, we control the vehicle for them getting their message across.
You have to make decisions. And every time you make a decision, you're doing something for somebody and cutting somebody else's gizzard out.
Yeah, and so sometimes we don't do it well.
Well, Bernie is one of 20 candidates, and there has to be, as we all know, a proportionate amount of coverage about most of them. Some of them, yes, we make a decision that person, he or she, doesn't have much of a chance, so he's going to get less coverage. On the other hand, 4 years ago, Bernie got all sorts of coverage. He got, some would argue, more than he deserved. Maybe he deserved it, but he was one of only a handful of candidates 4 years ago. So it all depends on the circumstance.
And I was on the other side of the notebook for a few years. You know, I worked as a flack for a member of Congress, and I felt the sting of reporters wanting to find something that was interesting, that was a wedge into a story that would be more exciting than just the recounting of what happened. So as a person trying to get your principle into the press, you're always imagining what kind of a clever thing will pique a reporter's interest. And that's annoying, you know, that really is. And I remember being a reporter covering the presidential campaign of Michael Dukakis and feeling as though my editors were pushing me to cover a particular storyline. In those days, it was the Pledge of Allegiance. Remember, Dukakis had signed a bill that said you don't have to say the Pledge of Allegiance before the day begins in Massachusetts public schools, and George H.W. Bush was attacking him for it. My editors wanted more on that. Well, if Dukakis was doing a particular presentation about an important issue, housing, say, or transportation, that just got lost in the dust because there was an appetite for the more scintillating.
Sexy. Mm-hmm.
An appetite by the people controlling the media.
Aha!
At the expense of the public learning what the candidate is trying to say.
Yes, it's tough. Those damn editors. We can't leave this week without taking a little note of the other Cuomo, for those of us who are here around New York, and that is the younger brother of the governor, who, if his older brother weren't governor, he would be, of course, considered the Cuomo. That is Chris Cuomo, a star, because that's how you say it in cable news these days, of
CNN. Would he have gotten a prominent role in the media if he wasn't the governor's brother?
Oh, yeah.
You think so?
I think he's really good at what he does.
Okay.
I mean, he's a good cable TV news
host. So you wouldn't describe him as Fredo?
I would not.
Okay, so there he is. He's with his wife. He's with his kid. A provocateur comes up and calls him Fredo.
Right. And he says, "I'll bleeping ruin your bleep." You know, you can't really quote what
he loses it.
Well, he said that the use of the word Fredo is akin to the N-word for Italians.
That I did not know.
I've never heard that.
Well, that's a big debate.
But that's what the writer of that article said.
Isn't Lombardo an Italian name, I believe?
Oh, that's right.
Would you be the expert in this room on that?
Well, I could wear many hats.
Well,
I'm Jewish, and I'm married to a guy who's half Italian, and I'm in the newspaper business.
There you go.
Okay, but here is one of the two Chartok twins, which got into too many fights.
Which one of you was older?
Which I was. 5 minutes. Which
and better looking, he'll tell you too.
Which, of course, I tell you, we were in too many fights,
huh.
And we took too many insults. And when somebody insulted us, we fought. And I realized later in life, you don't do that. It's stupid. Every time you let somebody sucker you by baiting you, I think Chris Cuomo knows that now. He really messed up, and he said so.
Well, you can't, whether you're a high-profile person like Chris Cuomo or anybody else, you should know in this day and age that if you're going to do something like that, someone near you is going to have a cell phone with a camera and video.
It's still stupid.
It is absolutely stupid.
Yeah, it's extra stupid.
Yeah.
Something
that doesn't make him Fredo.
Something that Fredo would do.
So, but should CNN have done anything other than stand with Chris Cuomo? They put out a statement that said Chris Cuomo defended himself when he was verbally attacked with the use of an ethnic slur in an orchestrated setup. We completely support him.
Well, he's their star. He's their star. And they're going to protect their star until he's not protected. What was it that was said of Thomas Eagleton? I'm 1,000% behind.
Yeah, but you know, but you might, I don't know whether you did, but I'm guessing that you were critical of Tucker Carlson and the way that he got a slap on the wrist from Fox. The only difference is that he didn't do it on the air. They can defend him. CNN can defend him privately, publicly rather, but privately they have to say to him, you know, you are Chris Cuomo of CNN. This is not the kind of conduct that you should be doing in public. You're not using the language that you're using in public. Don't do it
anymore. Which, Ira, is why he apologized. I'm sure he heard from them, and that's the solution.
I suspect that's right. All right, so we've run out of time.
No.
I can't wait to hear Alan's next interview with the governor. I want to hear if this comes up.
Is it true that your younger brother is Fredo?
Ooh,
not good. Don't do that. All right, for another day, the questions that you don't want to ask for good reason. All right, Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, and I'm Rex Smith, with gratitude to our producer, David Gustina, re-entering the room. Thanks to you all for listening to us on The Media Project.
Good job, gang.